You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Friday, July 12th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jared Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a special guest this week, George Robb.
Oh, dance with somebody.
So we are at Nexus 2019. This is our private show recording that we're doing.
Yes.
We're recording on July 12th, but this episode is going to air probably in early September when we are at DragonCon. So it'll be about 6 weeks or so delayed. That may be why some of the news items we're talking about happened a few weeks ago. You know, if you're prior to when this show is coming up, but that's okay. They're all pretty timeless. So how are you guys enjoying Nexus so far? We had a full day of workshops yesterday.
So this show will be back when, like, the world still existed, basically. Back 6 weeks ago. Previous. Before that thing happened.
Yeah,
remember when?
Right.
Yeah. Remember when that thing happened, like, 2 weeks ago?
Colossal event.
It was bad.
We didn't think it'd get any worse, and then it got worse. Yeah. And it just kind of kept getting worse. But this show was fun. Remember that show we did 6 weeks ago? Before the
We're
thing?
We're having fun now, before the thing happened.
The thing? Yeah, but, well,
if
it's good.
If only we knew.
Yeah.
You know, we would have eaten more ice cream.
It's true. Yeah. Screw exercise.
Say,
right.
Some would say we should have known.
Some would say.
Some would say.
Could have known.
Yeah.
How are you, Steve?
That's good. I did three workshops yesterday.
No, you did not.
I did.
What were they?
Great.
What were all three?
So George and I did Stump the Skeptic.
You did that one.
You
did that one, yeah. I was in the room. It was nice.
I misread that one. I thought that was Hump the Skeptic.
And then Jay, Brian, and I did one on media tropes of science and scientists.
Yeah.
Right, so that was good.
That was fun.
And then I did one on how to be a skeptical health consumer.
Mm, that's important.
Yeah. Good. The audiences were all great.
My second one was me and Brian's best picks in animation.
Mm-hmm. That was fun.
Which was probably better than yours.
Yeah.
What was number one, Jay? What was number one animated pick for you guys? Do you have a number one?
We didn't. I mean, it's hard to say because there's so many that we love. But
okay, never mind.
No, we started.
My standout for recent stuff is Moana.
Oh, yeah.
Moana was an absolute genius
piece
of work, from the music to the animation, the ocean and the hair, the facial expressions. And Moana also has that incredible lava demon. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a lava demon in that show that actually was a little scary.
Yeah.
It was scary the first time I saw it. I was like, damn.
Yeah, well done.
And so, the rock was in it.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Right.
Really? More like than Coraline or like any, like the Spirited Away? Come on.
They were all on the
Spirited
list.
Away
they were all on the list.
Lose away anything Disney put out. Let's face it.
Well, I guess The Nightmare Before Christmas, that we did include those on there. But yeah, that's got to be my all-time.
I wouldn't say it blows away Pixar movies. Pixar? Come on.
Yeah.
It's a different thing. It's a different thing.
It's different.
So this was yesterday, right? Let's just...
Yeah, sorry.
Today. But
don't
today.
You understand, Kara, that 6 weeks ago, the world went to shit.
Right.
Oh, right.
We're reminiscing, right?
We need to reminisce about all
this. We can still watch
films we lost.
Yeah. All right, so we do have some really interesting news items to talk about on this show. Bob, this one's amazing. So exogalactic exoplanets...
Yeah, this one has some interesting possibilities. So scientists are claiming that gravitational waves could potentially be used to not only detect exoplanets, but to detect them in other galaxies. Let that bounce around inside your head for a little bit. Who knows what gravitational waves are?
You have to clap.
Oh.
So you listen to the show because I've talked about it about 30 times.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go over it again real quick.
Okay.
Gravitational waves, Einstein predicted this in 1916 from his general relativity theory. It's basically ripples in space-time itself that propagate out from amazing intense events like colliding black holes or colliding neutron stars. So these are huge events that actually ripple through space-time and travel at the speed of light for, you know, forever.
Well, Bob, is it fair to say that smaller events also make gravitational waves, but they're just too small to detect?
Yeah. Anytime you've got mass moving and doing something, you're going to probably create them.
They're only detectable when you get to the black hole colliding level.
Well, yes, but this is right. As of right now, we can only detect them when you have huge masses colliding. But these new devices that are coming out should be able to detect other types of events with different frequencies of gravitational waves. So right now we've got LIGO. That's Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. We've got a couple of LIGO setups that can detect colliding black holes and neutron stars. And these are big facilities that have lasers at right angles to each other that can detect the compression and refraction of space-time. But in 10 years, we're going to have LISA, how are they pronouncing it?
LISA.
LISA is Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. So this is going to be three spacecraft separated by 1.5 million miles, and they will be shooting lasers between them. So imagine this huge triangle of these crafts, and then that will be able to detect other types of events in space that LIGO cannot detect. So this is the new idea. LISA should be able to detect events like binary white dwarfs in orbit around each other in a tight orbit. So that motion, that you know, the mass of a white dwarf is we're going. It's the mass of the sun, say, compressed down to the Earth, and they're in orbit around each other. So that's something that emits detectable gravitational waves. At least, hopefully, LISO should be able to detect that. So the idea is that a planet could be in orbit around these binaries. So what they say we should do is use LISA to detect thousands of these orbiting binaries. And they will have a specific signature. But if there's a planet or multiple planets in orbit around that, it should modify the gravitational wave to such an extent that it's detectable. So we can say, look, this is a gravitational wave of orbiting white dwarfs, but there's a little anomaly to it. There's a little adjustment to it, and that's probably caused by a planet.
So it would only be able to detect exoplanets at that distance if they're orbiting binary white dwarfs.
Right. That's not the main function of LISA. Hopefully, LISA has other
yeah,
uses.
Obviously.
But this is like, hey, using LISA, we can detect this stuff.
Can I ask a couple questions?
Yeah.
All right,
just
so you said in other galaxies.
Yeah.
Right.
So I can't wrap my mind around
like
this.
The Andromeda.
Galaxies. Yeah, but still, I mean, it's think about
Andromeda might be too far away. They're talking about
like dwarf galaxies.
No, they're talking about things like first off, the entirety of the Milky Way, essentially, which is huge, because when we detect exoplanets now, we're not detecting all of the Milky Way. It's relatively close by generally, and we cannot detect huge swaths of the Milky Way. And also, they're saying probably the Magellanic Clouds,
yeah,
which are on the order of, say, what, 170,000 light years away, something like that. Far beyond that, LISA might not be able to do that. But this would be potentially an extra galactic bound exoplanet, which has never been found. And if you think about it, like detecting an exoplanet potentially in another galaxy, any other galaxy, even if it's something like the Large Magellanic Cloud, is amazing.
But I wonder how often you have a system with two binary white dwarfs that actually still has a planet orbiting both of them. I mean, how do you get to the two closely orbiting white dwarfs?
Well, that's just it. Theory does not say that this scenario cannot happen. It doesn't rule it out.
It's not ruled out by physics, but...
Right, right.
Is it likely to be?
Well, right.
We don't know, I guess.
We don't know. And if we do find it, that's one of the interesting things about it. If we do find it, it's all about helping and extending planetary evolution, right? The theory of planetary evolution. So we could potentially find out that, hey, planets can survive the red giant phase of their star. Our sun will go into a red giant phase. Can planets that are relatively close, can they somehow survive? We're not 100% sure what the survivability is and where you need to be.
And Jupiter should survive.
The outer planets would survive. But what about some of the inner planets? So it could help us extend our theory of planetary evolution. Now, can some of these planets survive better or worse than we think? Or perhaps there is a second generation of planets that kind of can inhabit a post-red giant phase solar system. So maybe there's a second wave of planets that can somehow, you know...
Support life.
I guess.
That's cool.
Bob, the LIGO can detect, like, a wave which is less than the width of a proton, apparently? Something like that?
Yes.
How much...
The most sensitive devices,
yeah,
I think, ever created.
How much more sensitive is LISA going to be as compared?
We're talking a 1.5 million mile... it's not sensitivity's part of it, but as I learned yesterday from my friend Leonard, that it's not just it's extra sensitive. It's designed to be able to detect a specific frequency, and that's a frequency of, say, orbiting white dwarfs.
Oh, okay.
Whereas LIGO, Earthbound LIGO, is sensitive to the specific frequency of black holes colliding.
Okay.
And so for me, one of the holy grails of gravitational wave astronomy is detecting the very first moments after the Big Bang, going beyond the cosmic microwave background radiation that we can't get past now. And so it's kind of like it's a new window into the universe, which is what makes gravitational wave astronomy so amazing. It's a new branch of astrophysics that opened up in 2015 when they made that first discovery. So it's really such a breakthrough that I compare it to CRISPR, and what CRISPR has done to genetics is what I think gravitational wave astronomy is going to do to astronomy.
Wow.
It's just a whole new window. And this is just a prediction by some scientists. Yeah, we may be able to detect exoplanets. Jupiter, Jupiter scale and higher, not smaller than that. But if you imagine detecting planets in the large Magellanic Cloud, it's just amazing and unanticipated. I never thought that we'd
right.
be able to do
Are
that.
There any,
and who knows what else we could do with gravitational wave astronomy in the future.
Are there any laws of physics that need to be broken to use gravitational waves for, like, your phone? Or, like, for, like, you know what I mean? Like, for a device that somehow uses, instead of RF
like
signals, let's
like
say.
LaForge's visor.
That's what I mean. Like,
looking
at
gravitational waves.
Is there any, like laws of physics?
Limitations
of.
I would imagine.
If you had a sensitive enough instrument, right, you could use it for information to.
There's probably a wavelength limit.
Google's working on that, right, Charlie?
I wouldn't rule it out. Future technology in a century or what artificial intelligence could create.
Yeah.
Can you create at that scale? I don't know if it breaks any laws of physics.
Okay.
Or it may not be possible with any extrapolation of current technology, but not necessarily ruled out by some theoretical future technology.
Yeah.
You said that they're
Or I didn't. Wait, what was it? Say again?
Yeah, in the beginning you said that they were going to have three spacecraft.
Yeah.
You said, how far apart?
1.5 million miles.
So how far is that? Like, I can't picture it in my head. Like, can you give me an idea? It's like, is that out of our solar system? I don't know.
No.
I don't know. I'm asking.
Well, picture the moon is like 240,000 miles away.
Okay.
So six times the distance. I mean,
A few moons out there.
Okay. All right.
Cute.
That's
many
cool.
moons away.
That'll be our biggest instrument ever created by mankind.
If you count that as one thing.
Yeah,
it is.
I mean, the sun
is
93 million miles away, so that gives you some context,
right.
I guess.
I have one more question on this, Bob. Has anyone made a scale model of LIGO out of Legos?
I don't know.
No.
Awesome question, Steve. I'll get
right,
on
look
that
into
one.
That. Look into that. Right, Kara.
Yes, that's me.
So it's amazing what paleontologists can tell from a single tooth.
Yes. I have been reading up a little bit on Denisovans, which we've talked about the Denisovans on the show before. It was interesting because this news article is one of several that came out of a new Denisovan discovery. Because whenever there's a new specimen that's found, multiple people work with it and lots of papers usually come out of it. But I didn't realize that there's only been, let me see, 6 Denisovan specimens ever discovered. And they're all just, it's a toe bone, a couple teeth, a partial jawbone. That's it. That's all we have.
Can you describe what they are?
So they're hominins. They're homos, early genus homos. And 600,000...
They may have all been like Sherpas, right? They like adapted to high altitudes.
That's one hypothesis. Yeah. And also, there's a lot of the fossil evidence comes from Asia. So it's a different region of the globe where the Denisovans were. And we've known for some time now, the way that we know that we have admixture with Neanderthals, we've known for some time there's some genetic information that we've tested to show that we have admixture with Denisovans. This new study comes from investigations of a tooth that was actually found in the jawbone, which is really cool. And like the images are super cool. You can look online. And the tooth has three roots. So modern humans have two roots, but there's some variation. Sometimes it's a mutational variation, but the rate of a three root molar in modern humans is around 3.5% of the population in Europe and Africa. But in Asia, the rate is upwards of 40%.
Wow. So we're saying this is a link to...
So these researchers seeing this tooth are making the claim, not based on genetic evidence, but based on morphological evidence, that there is more Denisovan admixture in these Asian...
I had one.
Makes sense.
Really?
When they pulled my wisdom teeth out,
you had a triple?
I only had three wisdom teeth, and one of them was a triple.
Oh, interesting. Yep. Yeah, so that's a low, really low occurrence.
So is it magic? magical then?
I think it might be.
Yeah.
I think your mouth stone might be magical.
So is that a mutation? Is that more? Could you say that his was more of a mutation, like Jay's a mutant?
Hard
or
to say. That's Denise. But that's the interesting thing, and some of the researchers who are speaking out, not speaking out in the media, it's not some big controversy, but the people who have said, not so fast, this could be a mutation. We have very few specimens.
That's the problem.
But it seems to be the case that historical Denisovans in the Asian region may have the three molars. We know that at least one has the three rooted molars. Modern Asians have a higher rate of it, but we don't find older Homo sapiens that have it in the same region.
That's
why they think it was probably an admixture thing and that it didn't develop within the Homo sapien line. So that it's good evidence, but they need to now look at the genetics and they need to now obviously wait and see if they find more specimens. But it's really good.
Denisovans or modern
both
humans?
Of modern humans. Comparing, if they can figure out the gene that would have accounted for that. The teeth have DNA. Yeah, they're not that old. Let me see. How old is this tooth?
The nerves in the teeth probably have DNA, right? But not the tooth itself.
The pulp.
That's all.
The pulp in the tooth.
Yeah, the pulp in the tooth. 160,000 years old. And if you look at actually the eight specimens that are out there, the DNA has been investigated in almost all of them. One of them was so degraded that they could only do like protein analysis. But they've been able to do DNA analysis of most of the teeth and bones that have been found.
That is really cool.
I know.
If they didn't pull that tooth, I might have developed mutant powers.
You might have. Because I'm pretty sure the Denisovans had mutant powers.
Yeah.
I think that's how that works.
And I would have been. This is weird because I like teeth and I like teeth.
I know you're kind of. He was like jealous when I told him I was doing a teeth.
He's like, Jay, I have a tooth, news item. I'm like,
that's my domain. Yeah.
We all have mutant powers. I can digest lactose.
That's true. I have that too.
Yeah.
And Steve's a super taster.
Yeah.
I am too.
It's
not a good mutant power.
I got you all beat. I'm immune to caffeine.
Yeah, so you say.
So I say. I've done experiments on this, and he's like, I did an experiment for a month. I did an experiment. I quit caffeinated coffee for an entire month. I had no symptoms of no headaches, nothing.
So it's totally subjectively symptom based.
So then he's like, you should have done it for 6 weeks. I'm like, oh, come on, really?
Yeah, but the odd thing about this is Bob doesn't drink it; he pours it on himself,
and I absorb it through my skin. Yeah. Some people do that.
No, but Bob, legit, like, you blow my mind because I've developed like my whole. I quit caffeine just like Steve did because I don't sleep well, and caffeine is like the very first thing that a doctor will say is stop drinking caffeine.
People say to me. Oh, yeah, I can't have caffeinated coffee. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm like, are you kidding? I could drink a pot of coffee at midnight and go right to bed.
Yeah, we met last night at 10:30, and you were drinking
coffee. Yeah, you drank coffee.
But I successfully talked Bob into actually going to decaf.
Did you?
Well, it just,
yeah, like, why? Yeah, why even?
Caffeine's a chemical. Why just?
Well, and you said that it's the same for you, decaf.
Yeah, so if it's irrelevant, why not just drink decaf?
So weird. I don't get it.
And yeah.
But anyway.
All right.
Back to the teeth.
Let's go back to the teeth.
But
I was going to say about the tooth thing. What's interesting is, I'm not sure still how true this is, but there are some anatomical features that are typical of people living in the Asian continent that some paleontologists claim can be seen even as far back as Homo erectus in Asia.
Cool.
Like there are. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so think about what the implications of that would be. As far, even with previous species of hominins, that there was the interbreeding was happening enough that there are traits that carried all the way forward. Like there are regional traits that carried forward even across species line, which seems weird to me.
Well, but
I'm
shows
not sure
you,
how solid that is at this point.
But it also shows you how inexact a science taxonomy has historically been, because originally taxonomy was all based on morphology, based on how things looked. And then we were able to do genetic testing, and we were able to say, okay, this is a distinct species because it's genetically this far apart. Modern, extant species, we often will say, it's a different species if it can't produce viable offspring. Mm-hmm. But there's literally no way for us to know if a, Homo erectus could have bred with a, a different Homo species. So they're all the same genus. But how arbitrary is that distinction between genus and species based on
totally
a few teeth and a toe?
Because it's a continuum.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's no objective place to draw a line.
I mean, it's, you know, we can say with some assurance that like Homo Neanderthalus or whatever was a distinct species or a subspecies, however you want to do it, that has died off and, yeah. you know, some of the DNA. And it's the same with Denisovan and things like that. But when we look at these individual characters, I mean, there's a great quote here from a researcher who didn't work on this, who said, it's a very interesting suggestion, but without genetic evidence, I think it's premature to declare that this one fossil provides compelling morphological evidence of Denisovan admixture in Asian-derived populations.
Well, sure.
And so the question here is, like, we need more fossils.
Yeah.
When you have more fossils, you know if it just didn't end up, like, if it's not just Jay, if that was right. just a fossil of Jay who happened to have this one tooth, it's not indicative of Denisovan's at all.
It's not generalizable.
Yeah,
it's too small a sample.
It's so hard to
tell.
Well,
that's always that was the same problem with the hobbits, right? The Homo neanderthalensis. We had one specimen. Is it a freak or mm-hmm. is it a representative of a subspecies? Well, we don't know until we find the second one mm-hmm. and then the third one. So it's the same thing. You know, was this a coincidence that we happen to have a fossil of a three-toothed?
Now, should I send my tooth? I still have them. Should I send it to the scientists?
You might want to. You might also, have you done a 23andMe or any sort of genetic test? It'd be interesting to see what your Asian lineage is.
Yeah, right?
Actually.
Oh, wow. That is cool.
Find that out, and you can see if you have a lot of.
They call that tooth tracking.
Tooth tracking. Yeah. Mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, all right. So, what about the idea, though? If even without good genetic evidence, we still have the fact that Asians have 40 in that area have 40%.
But that could have been an early mutation in Homo sapiens,
right?
That then stayed within that region. You know, gene
okay.
flow
are there any other explanations?
Yeah, bottleneck.
Do these findings allow me to feel less guilty about not flossing?
No.
Does that enter into
no.
it
not
at all?
No.
Yeah.
no.
Not at all.
Right. No.
Just do it, George.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's important.
Do we need to have the freaking talk? George, flossing is like...
Don't get Jay going.
Do you ever floss?
Sure.
yeah. I can't not floss. I have floss in my handbag all the time because I hate that feeling of like...
Yeah.
But you know how you have like... Everybody has like that one tooth?
Yeah.
The gap.
Like right here? Yeah, where I'm always...
Three
yeah. Sticks in there, yeah.
The three yeah, that molar. I have all my wisdom teeth. Who has their wisdom teeth?
I have
two of mine. I still have two.
Yeah. Very wise.
You got yours taken out?
Mm-hmm.
You got yours taken out?
Oh, God. Mm.
Yeah, all four.
Still in?
Still in.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm less involved.
There's a hypothesis, I don't know how accepted it is, that modern humans, because we eat less tough food, mm-hmm. our jaws are underdeveloped and our teeth are crowded for that reason.
Yes.
Look back at Cro-Magnon man, for example.
Got a Cro-Magnon
bigger jaws.
Jaw. yeah.
Perfect teeth. Like, they didn't have braces, you know.
Yep.
And because they had just more room. Mm-hmm. So our mouths are overcrowded.
Crowded.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Steve, wasn't that based on the study? Somebody went to some tribe somewhere and everybody in that tribe had perfect teeth. And he was trying to figure out why. And he said, because as you're eating food for the first time, if it's not baby food, if it's tough, rough food that you've got to crunch, that actually it builds up your jaw a little bit and gives more room for the teeth.
Interesting.
So I don't think that's at the point where we could say that's accepted consensus, but that's like a hypothesis at this point. But it's interesting that we're, you know, adversely affecting our teeth because of our baby food.
And of course, mothers will say, I don't care. I'm going to feed my baby food because I don't want because they're paranoid about a baby choking. So like, I'll pay for braces down the line. I just don't want them to eat anything.
Yeah, it's better if your baby didn't die.
Yeah,
just let's make sure it lives long enough to need braces. That's
do you ever had like eat something like we were eating last night? We went to
it was a Middle Eastern restaurant.
Yeah,
it was
so
Flay Flay.
So I had some I had some tabbouleh, and it's got a lot of parsley. It is basically parsley with some other stuff in it. And I 2 hours later, I'm home. I'm at home at the hotel, and I'm brushing my teeth.
Flossing.
And I look in, and there was a big green. And it occurred to me that nobody loves me.
That is true. You know you have a friend when they can tell you got something.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And
Carol noticed it.
I mean, Steve, it was like this. You know, I'm like, hey, how you doing? So,
tree sticking out of your mouth?
Yeah, I agree. That's a duty of friends. That is your duty.
I was with family. It was you guys.
Right. Your breath stinks.
You got to blow your nose. Something's going on.
Body odor. All that's good.
That's a duty. You're not a friend.
But there's.
I get it, but it is hard for people to be like, you got a little boogie.
No.
I don't want to make you embarrassed. Or like your flies down. Like, because this, how do you do it? You have to be like,
just do it.
Dude, your flies been.
Yeah.
So
don't walk over to them and start, you know.
No. But like, okay, I want to know from everybody here, if I don't know you and your flies down, but it's like, hello, should I tell you?
But this is what you do. You say, Are you selling hot dogs?
I do not say that. I just want to...
I actually remembered that joke and edited it out. The fact that you said it just blows my mind. That's it. I am off the fucking rails right now.
Steve, what did you do?
That never happened before.
But it occurred to me, though, that
this is the slippery slope fallacy in action.
I know. Remember what I did in England? There's a parallel. There's a parallel between people not telling you that there's food in your teeth and, say, like one of those singing competition shows.
Because
the people that are allowed to walk in that room
have
and sing,
no good friends.
Nobody loves those people at all. Because that is like world shaming.
Oh, it's horrible.
Yes.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Somebody knows them, knows they're terrible, and let them go on TV and shame themselves because they were too embarrassed to say, dude, really.
We don't know that they didn't get the warning and still went anyway.
No, we do. I auditioned for season 2 of American Idol, and I went through multiple callbacks. Like, I actually got accepted all the way to the very end before I got cut. And I remember having these moments of panic because I would see good people and terrible people, and no one in between.
And you don't know who you are.
And I'm like,
I don't know what group you're in.
I am a trained jazz singer. Like, I think I'm not terrible. I think I was in the good group that wasn't good enough because I was really. This was before I did any television. I was super camera shy and like I didn't like shine on camera. You know what I mean? So I could sing, but I was like, oh, okay, sorry, I don't want to interrupt. And they just were like, you're not ready to be on TV. But I would see people come in who were just, oh, it was so sad. Yeah. And you're right, they were just completely unaware. And I mean, some of them I think leaned into it. Mm-hmm. Like they knew it was fun. Yeah, like there was a girl.
There was a gimmick.
There was a girl who like wrapped her pants in Christmas lights and she plugged herself in before she auditioned. Like there were things like that where it was a show and they were having fun.
Yeah, they wear costumes and all that.
Yeah.
So Karen,
but this was only the second season, so it was kind of before the real crazy started on the show. But
to answer your question, if it's a stranger, it depends. You don't have to because you're not a close friend. But if there's somebody at work and you don't really know them and they're like going to go talk to their boss and their flies open, then you could say, hey, by the way, but you have no duty since you are not a good friend. But the good friends really need to step up.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I agree. I would tell somebody their flies open in the right situation, but I might not do the parsley teeth thing with some rando I don't know.
No.
Yeah. Rando.
I like that
term. Jay, I did not see it. I would have told you. We didn't have to.
You know what? I remembered.
That's
you had
right,
pizza
I
last
there.
Night.
I had pizza.
But I'm sitting across from Steve.
I didn't see it, Jay.
I don't believe that. No, it's too convenient. It's too, you know.
I'm like, I wouldn't tell you.
I just don't trust you anymore. I still love you.
George, we're going to take a break from the news items.
Sure.
Cool. To do some George questions.
Mm. I was curious to talk about this topic because it doesn't come up that often. These two funerals that I went to were kind of non-traditional. One was just we all met by the graveside and we talked about the person and it was very lovely. His bandmates. He actually was the guitarist for Sister Sledge. They did We Are Family. Mm-hmm. You know, that's his thing, and that was his current band. And the band members came. They told this great story about how Nile Rodgers, who wrote the guitar riff for that Sister Sledge song, was at a gig once and he didn't know how to play the riff that he wrote because he had written it 30 years previous. So this guitarist had to show it to him. So he had to teach him his own guitar riff. And it was a great story. It was really very marked because Mark was a wonderful guitarist. The other one was my cousin-in-law's father passed away back in Thanksgiving and he was in hospice. And part of, as he was knew he was, his time was limited, he said, I don't want a funeral. I would like a memorial, but I want you guys to wait at least 6 months before you do anything because I want you all to get together after the shock of my sort of passing has gone, and I just want you to celebrate my life and what I had. And we had this get-together. It was 7 months later, and it was really wonderful. It was, we all got to see each other. It was both sides of the family. They set up these three tables. One table had all of his craft work. He was an electrical engineer, and in his spare time, he would do these amazing crafts. He would build dollhouse furniture for his nieces. He would do these sconces for like kitchens and all kinds of stuff. The second table was a video display. He would do local plays, local productions. So it was all of the covers of all the plays he had done. And then this rolling footage of him just acting in these shows. Whenever they needed like a grumpy old man in whatever show it was, he would play that part. And the third table was just a TV screen with just photos from his entire life. And it was wonderful. It was just really wonderful. And it got me thinking like, what would I want for my sort of last thing? You always, when you're at a funeral, you always have that sort of mild fantasy in your head of like, what will my funeral be like? Who will be there? Who won't be there? You know, will Jay do the scream thing at some point? And I was wondering, have you guys thought at all about what you would want to be your sort of memorial thing, what you don't want it to be? Like, I've told my parents, like, if I'm going home today from this gathering and I'm gone tomorrow, like, please don't do the church thing. Because my mom will want to do the Catholic church thing. Right. And I said, like, just if there's any semblance of like, please just don't put me in a church, because all of whatever friends may show up are just going to be rolling their eyes so hard through this thing. Yeah. And it has nothing to do with me. And I understand you want that, and I understand it'd be good for you. But please, if you have any sort of respect of what I would want, just like, do anything else. Just don't do the church thing.
Yeah.
I've been very vehement about that. But if you guys, I'm just curious as to how you guys have thought about what you would want or wouldn't want.
Do you mean, so question, because I think this is two different things. Do you mean like if I died tomorrow, or do you mean if I died elderly, the way that you're
elderly?
Because those are two very different.
Like, ideally, like, if you have a nice long life, what would you like your sort of funeral arrangements to be, or not to be?
Secular. I think that's
secular,
number
absolutely.
One.
Right.
Yeah, no mention of God.
Sure.
That's weird. Yeah. Although I have a friend whose sister died recently. I think I mentioned this on the show. And do you guys know Ryan Bell? Some of you might actually know. He's a humanist chaplain at USC, and he's like big in the skeptic, but also in like the atheist community. And so, you know, my friend reached out to me and said, do you know anybody who can do like a secular service, like a secular priest or something? Because he was, I think, Adventist, or I can't remember, before he was a pastor, before he's the Year Without God guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he actually officiated, and they did this smart thing where even on the program, it said, like, in honor of her parents' Jewish faith, there will be the whatever, I don't know what you do at a Jewish funeral, but the reading of this and the blah, blah, blah. And in honor of her lack of faith, the remainder of the service will be secular in nature. So they kind of did a cool hybrid thing for the people.
It was a hybrid?
It was a hybrid.
Yeah.
Wait, now you stole the tooth. You're not stealing.
I don't even know what it's from.
Mine is either from Thanksgiving.
Because they're always from these really nerdy things, and I'm just like, you've explained most of them.
It's from Caddyshack.
I don't care.
It's a cross.
Caddyshack, really.
It's a cross between California Sensimilia and Kentucky Bluegrass.
It's a hybrid.
This is what I deal with the whole show. You know? So much gets edited out.
We didn't quote movies. What would we talk about?
I know. City of Heroes.
Ooh.
Oh, God. There's so much City of Heroes.
So, all right. My thinking, George, has always been, I don't care because I'm dead.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly.
Well,
honestly, that's your thinking?
Yeah. My thinking is,
you don't want some kind of a
it's
thing.
About survivors?
Whatever the people who I leave behind want, whatever's good for them. Because seriously, I'm dead.
Yeah, but Steve.
I know. Right.
But Steve, there is an element of, too. Like, you're trying to do things. Like, you're trying to have some insight into, okay, if I'm going to die, I'm leaving my, you have two daughters and a wife. Yeah. What would be a nice.
I die first.
You're going to die first, yeah.
Yeah, probably. Statistically.
Yeah, But you know what I mean. Like, it's things that you could do to make them feel better.
That's what I'm saying. That was my point.
No, but the thing is, leaving it up to them.
You have to think about it.
Leaving it up to them means they have to do all the work.
Right, you have to think
about
it.
When they're already mourning, that's a lot of pressure.
But what if they hate his decisions?
It doesn't matter. Then he can say, you can alter these as
you
will.
Well, make plans ahead of time.
That's what I'm saying. Like, plan things so that when they can just go through the checklist to make it easier on themselves.
Whatever makes it easier. So the thing is, I understand the legacy thing. I don't think my funeral has a significant impact on my legacy.
Right.
I think my life will be my legacy, not my funeral.
Yeah.
So I'm not worried about what role the funeral is playing in my legacy. And the funeral is just about the people who I leave behind dealing with the fact that I'm dead. So whatever works for them. Logistically, dealing with all that stuff, they don't have to deal with it. Great. That's
but what
fine.
If like your funeral is like a giant LARP? Like, what if you just do something crazy at your funeral?
That's
Like, you expect everybody to dress up like a wizard or something like
if
that.
If they want to do that,
All right. I want Steve to have, like, the full-on Viking thing.
Oh,
floats out.
Dirge. Flaming boat.
We have all these, like, candles floating.
You fire arrows at the body out.
Yeah.
And set it on fire.
So part of the service, right, or whether it be a wake or a memorial or an actual funeral, is the tradition around disposal.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
That's an interesting
the tree
question.
Thing.
Does everybody know what they want to do with their body when they die?
Jay
does.
I do.
You want to be a tree?
Jay wants to be frozen.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mind being frozen.
Doing the frozen thing.
I'm not
it's my wife and I were 100% going to do it, and now we're on the fence because we have kids, and it's a lot of money. And then I'm like, is it worth it? Because the chance of it working is very, very, very small.
Also, do you even want to be alive?
Yeah.
Listen to last week's This American Life. I don't know if you heard it.
I haven't heard it.
Oh, they do one on cryo?
It's all about cryo. Yeah, it's an older story they updated, but it's
It's still not
Someone has to make a movie of this first guy because it's such a comedy of errors.
It is such a comedy of errors. Oh my God,
the history of it. Like multiple people were in like what was meant to be one tube for one person. They were putting like 3, 4, 5 people because
stacking
they
them up.
Yeah, they didn't have the facilities to do. And right. So this guy was like, okay, well, we'll fit. And he wasn't telling anybody. And it's a comedy.
But, all right, but that doesn't necessarily reflect on the current state of some of the.
If they put you in the ground, what are the odds of you coming back? Zero, right?
What if there was some AI that could figure out what your personality was from like the 700 shows that you've done?
No, yeah, there's a Black Mirror on that.
But there's no continuity.
But that's not
your
you,
brain.
That's
an... If you don't have this piece of meat in your head, no inferring brings you back. It's
you could be indistinguishable to other people.
Yeah, yeah, but, that's no, but you not wake up all of a sudden and you've woken up and it's like we've reconstructed you from.
Yeah,
from your whatever, your
from what,
podcast
Facebook?
Legacy,
from
your Facebook, yeah, yeah,
yeah. With Facebook, with a lot of people, it'd basically be revolving around food
and babies
and baby. Yeah. All right, I'm going to answer your question.
Anyway, yeah.
Let's put the, so first, I thought with an extensive detail how I would like everyone else in my life to die. Mm-hmm. Not so much. No, but I
usually late at night alone.
Plotting. This one involves flame. This one involves a car. This one involves a sword.
I love that voice. Yes. So I think I'm the one out of all of us up here who's the most preoccupied with my mortality.
I don't know. I think I might be, but I think you're the most afraid of death.
Yeah, I just don't want to stop existing because what the fuck.
But know. I think about death like all day, every day too.
Yeah. So, but I've thought about.
I have high mortality salience.
That's why I think I jumped on Steve a little bit because I've thought about like what I want to do. Now, this is going to sound a little weird, but because my wife is sitting in the audience, I can't say one of the things I thought of because it's a surprise for her.
Oh my. Is that a threat?
We take a huge cake. We roll the cake out, and there's a big spring in the bottom of the cake.
But Courtney's sister knows it, but Courtney does not
know.
Wow. She's horrified.
Funeral surprise. Together, yeah. You know?
Yeah. That reminds me real quick, Jay.
Those set up coffin things, you know.
Does anyone know a ventriloquist?
our friend Larry seriously wants this to happen at his funeral. It won't happen.
Say why, though.
Wait, there's a why? Yeah. It's Larry. I mean, it's Larry. He wants to be rigged in his open coffin to when everyone's there to sit up and wave.
So, animatron.
Sadly, Larry. Only half the story.
Really?
So Larry, our friend Larry, is late to everything. He wants to be late to his own funeral. And it has to be a hustle and bustle with like, because when Larry's late, he's always like, he's coming into the room. And then he definitely wants the coffin door to open up and then straight backed like that, like that. And I'm probably the one that would make it happen. I can't. What do you? How?
I think it's great.
How would you even begin? Like,
you could do that.
You go to the funeral parlor and you're like, how do you get a corpse to sit up? Like, it's not going to happen.
If anyone knows, they're going to know.
It'll happen. You could do it.
How?
Hologram.
Your post.
It might not be legal.
No, it's legal.
All right.
Yeah, that's legal. You can do whatever you want. Pseudo property.
The corpse could make involuntary noises. By the way.
Involuntary.
But usually by then...
There's nothing voluntary going on.
No, but by then it's embalmed.
Yeah.
It's not really...
You don't have to be embalmed, though.
No. But if you
You'd have to.
If you want to rig a body
you don't
into like a day
later...
Do you guys want to be embalmed? Do you want to be embalmed?
No, I want to donate my body to science.
I don't care.
I like the science donation. I don't want to be embalmed.
And then they give you back like a bag of meat at the end?
Yeah.
No. They have to... Legally, it's kind of weird.
It's just a random bag of meat. I think it's pork chops and some sausage.
So, no, I did an episode about this, and I learned all about the ins and outs of it. So they legally have to cremate you, which kind of is a bummer because I don't want to be cremated. I mean, only because of the, like...
Carbon, the
environmental impact. But usually by the time you come back, so there's a quality control person who's supposed to make sure all of your parts are kept, which is kind of silly, but whatever. Because a lot of this stuff happens in overseas. So you donate your body to science, it'll be often going to like India or China for research purposes or industrial purposes, whatever you want, or whatever they want. You don't have any control over that. And then they'll keep all your parts together, but usually you're completely mangled and stuff, and they keep all your parts together, and then they'll cremate you. and they'll send back the crewmen.
I just changed my mind. I do not want to. No, I'm not going to China and India as a corpse. Like,
why? You're helping people.
I'll send me to Canada.
You can't choose.
They will treat me. You guys will treat me nice.
The thing is, you can't choose. But the cool thing is,
wait. You just said I could do whatever I want with the corpse.
You can't if you donate your body to a tissue bank. You can't choose what it's used for. But they will. The good tissue banks, the regulated ones, will send you back the cremains, and they will give you a certificate.
Did you say cremains?
That's awesome.
Cool.
And they'll send you a tissue. They'll send you a certificate to your family that says. Vaguely, usually it won't say the actual institution, but it'll say vaguely what you were used for. Like so-and-so donation helped us improve cancer research or helped improve, you know.
Wow, that's cool.
To finish ballistics testing.
But it might say that, yeah, Carson.
What do you think about human composting?
Human composting is cool. It's legal now in Washington State. Right?
That is one step away from...
I want the mushroom suit. Have you seen the mushroom suit?
Yeah.
You get buried in this suit that has these little mushroom seeds or sort of spores in it. And then you get buried, and then the mushrooms kind of eat you.
Are these zombie mushrooms?
I hope so.
But that's not legal almost anywhere in the U.S., which sucks. That's the thing about...
I thought there were some places that you can...
You might be able to go to. But even in a lot of natural burial sites, there are regulations about you have to be in a wicker...
Oh, okay.
All right, I figured it out, George. All right. I want my body to be used for live action Plants versus Zombies.
Definitely not legal.
But Jay, what do you want for your get together that happens after you're gone? Do you want to get together? Do you want a party? Do you want
when my father died 2 years ago, we had such an intense like 3 months of just crippling remorse that, you know, like I don't want to tell people like, don't cry. You don't have to cry. Like, it doesn't matter how old you are. People love you and they lose you. Like, you gotta let. I like the guy that said, wait 6 months, get over the bad thing.
Really,
and then
cool.
just kind of celebrate who I was. Like, I love that. That's cool.
No, I was at your father's memorial. I guess it was the viewing.
Yep.
And I didn't know your dad very well. But after that viewing, I got a real sense of who he was, which I really appreciated between the pictures and the stories that were being told.
Yeah.
That to me was really special. And
the only thing that was sad about it was like, shit, all these people should have got together before he died.
Of course.
We were seeing people that we hadn't seen in 20 years, people coming out of the woodwork. Yeah. Like, oh, yeah, you. I remember you when I was 10. Yeah. And they were saying like what he meant to them and everything. Yep. So I thought like that's like they throw you the best party on the one day they know you can't come.
Right?
Yeah. Is that... You know, we should do. That's why I don't really care that much about the funeral because I'm fucking dead. I think if you really care about somebody, do it while they're alive.
I know.
Well,
my friend Alyssa,
who had
stomach cancer, and she knew she had limited time.
Yeah.
And everyone came to visit her. And it was this like 2 week span of people traveled across the country. This is a former bandmate. She was very, very ill for a long time and then like super ill. And we all knew it was done. But we all got to see her and we all got to tell her, like, you are awesome. We love you. And she got to hear it and she almost believed it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of person she was. And I thought, wow, how cool is that to not then have to. And then her mom did not have a funeral.
Yeah.
Because she was like, everybody came.
Yeah.
Everybody was here. And they told her, what are we going to do?
But you can't. Isn't that better?
But also different strokes. Yeah. Because, like, I have a friend who died of breast cancer at 32. She was really young. And she, in her final, when she started to really go downhill and it was like the 2 months hospice left, she did not want to see anybody.
Yeah.
Like, it
yeah.
was very uncomfortable.
You can't
for her.
Predict it.
Because
right?
also, the thing is, a lot of people don't know how to act around people who are dying and it becomes a very awkward thing. And so I think it really depends on what you want.
Yeah. About a week or two before he went.
That was
rough.
That was the second hardest thing I ever had to go through, you know, to say goodbye. Mike Lassell was our number one listener, fan.
Yeah.
We don't like to use the word fan because it's...
Yeah, he called himself that, but
But you're friends.
But yeah, so then he came to the very first conference that we did, the Perry DeAngelis Memorial.
Right,
And then it was weird because we instantly were just like, oh, this guy is... It was like with you, George. We met and we were like, whoa. Like, awesome, what? We're going to stay in touch. And then he turned into, like, a deep friendship.
Even better than George.
Mike...
You were disinvited to the funeral, Bob.
Mike's heart biology was backwards. And they had to redo his heart when he was a baby. It was like a miracle surgery that they... They actually kind of invented
alive,
procedures with him. You know, like, he was like, we got to try to keep this kid alive. So I went up to see him, and my wife and I went up to see him in the hospital, and
it's tough.
It was so you don't know what to say. I'm like trying to like, all right, let me give him some normalcy, you know. And I told him it's like, tough. What do you want me to bring you? And he wanted soda that he couldn't get in Canada. which was like, you know, he just was a really big fan of a lot of like food items from the United States.
Yeah.
Is that a Canadian thing?
You better study up. Do you like food in Canada? Is food a thing? You only have food, right?
They have milk in a bag. I know.
Like moose jerky.
They have ketchup flavored chips.
I mean,
all dressed.
I said something to him. The hardest moment was like we're leaving.
Yeah.
And we all knew we weren't going to see each other again.
Right.
And I'm like sitting there like for an hour before we were leaving. I'm like, how do I say goodbye to Mike?
How do
I walk?
Like, some people want that. Some people don't. Some people it's just like, see you later. Like they don't want to say goodbye.
I wanted to be there when he passed away to be there for him.
Well, and that's a really cool. So a lot of hospice programs more recently have volunteer programs called like Nobody Dies Alone programs for people who don't have family or a lot of support. So they're on call, like volunteers are on call so that when we know somebody's close, at least there's somebody holding your hand and sitting with you. Because in the last final moments, if you're still aware, there's often like an intense fear that people go through. And so having somebody with you to kind of just help you through that
fear. Can you imagine being alone during those moments?
A lot if people die alone.
Yeah. I mean, if he asked me and Courtney, I think we would have stayed.
Yeah.
You know, but it was just very, it was, I hate to say this because it just sounds like I'm being selfish, but it was really awkward.
Of course.
No, of course. Then, it's probably awkward for him too.
I went up, I kissed him, I hugged him. And then his favorite movie was
Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm. So the very last thing I said to him, I'll see you on the other side.
Yeah.
And he totally got it. You know, he totally understood in that moment.
Yeah.
He looked the way he looked at me. But I mean, it's like, what else can you say? Like, we didn't have time to review our friendship, and there wasn't a lot of time. That was tough, but I felt awesome that we drove up there and saw him. It was so important to me and Courtney to give him that and to get what we got out of it.
Well, and so there's a cool, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to work towards in my PhD program is becoming a hospice psychotherapist. And so there's a cool body of literature. A lot of it's in the existential area around mortality, salience, understanding your own death, being really aware of it. And then when people are getting close, the types of therapies that are available. And one of the ones that seems to have really good evidence behind it and good feedback is life review therapy. So it's working with people when they're in hospice to like either make videos or to write books or to do things so that they can actually do, like you said, that life review and, you know, look for meaningful times in their life and remember the things that really mattered and put them on paper or put them on video for their loved ones so that A, they leave behind a legacy, and B, they get to go through the psychological process of like kind of coming to closure.
Yeah.
You know, I think for a lot of people, it's about going through the past and really thinking about all the amazing things that happened in their lives and what they gained from it and who they are. So one of the more, I think, modern existential views is that death is a stage of growth.
Yeah.
It's a process and it's life. It's not the end. It's a stage where you can actually really learn things about yourself and grow. And so embracing it in that way and not
death at the very end.
But the death and dying process can be something where a lot of meaning can come from it. And so there's a lot of, I think, newer understandings of that.
Challenging with Alzheimer's.
It's very challenging.
Rich and I went through that last year with my wife's mom. And that was a 6-year decline. That was really, really tough.
Yeah. Did you talk with your dad at all about what he wanted, or did that?
Yeah, we it was
that conversation.
Yeah, he really didn't want to. Well, 2 days before my dad passed away, when I after two, you know, all this time has gone by and collecting data, like talking to my mom and us talking to each other, we realized that my dad knew he was going to die.
Yeah.
So he did not want to die in a hospital. He I think he was like he felt it. You know, his heart gave out. Right. Mm-hmm. My mom was like giving tons of information that she never really shared before. She's like, you know, he absolutely had symptoms. He was acting strange the last couple of weeks because, you know, I think my dad knew it. And he just wanted to see his family. And we had a family party that happened. It was very impromptu that happened, which, again, he looked back and like, yeah, he knew. Because he got to see all the family that was local that was alive.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he saw Bob and Steve 2 days before he passed away. And he had a serious talk with them, which was awesome. But I got it was the night before.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
One thing that my wife did for me that was amazing for me was that a couple of years before my dad died, and you know, my 50th birthday was 2 years away. She, you know, or whatever, like a year and a half away. She went to my parents' house. I didn't even know this happened. And she sat down and video recorded a discussion with my dad about me.
Mm-hmm.
So she's talking to him and, you know, what's your favorite memory of Jay? You know, like he didn't even know. Didn't even know what was going on. And she gave it to me for my 50th birthday. And that was just like...
That's great.
And that's that. Yeah, oh, my God. Very similar.
That crippled me, though. That was like so awesome.
But you,
awesome.
I mean, you're going to have that for your whole life. You can always look at that when you miss it.
That's what I think people want.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially feelers. Like people who are very emotionally based. They want, and this is what I want to give anyone I can, is just let them know what I thought about them. Let them know, you know, in no uncertain terms, good, bad, or indifferent.
So we have two global warming related news items. One.
Speaking of death.
It doesn't matter because we're all going to die anyway.
Remember 6 weeks ago?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Before that thing happened. Several people have emailed us recently about a new paper that's going on. It's actually pre-published. It's not peer-reviewed or published. And the bottom line claim of this paper is that changes in cloud cover can explain all of the temperature changes in the last 50 plus years.
What?
Therefore, there's no room left over for CO2. Therefore, there's no man-made global warming. Right?
See, that carrot's all set. Done.
So
because of the clouds.
Because of the clouds. Because we could dump as much CO2 as you want into the atmosphere. It doesn't matter. Because it has no effect on the
And that's that.
So actually...
So I'm not surprised it's not peer-reviewed.
No, it's brought to you by Exxon did this report.
They have some of the best climate
The lead author is Jay Kaupinen, who's Finnish. I tried to find more information on it, but apparently that's a very common name in Finland.
Mm. I think he's more done than finished.
Yeah. So he's a physicist, not a atmospheric scientist. But I found another paper from 2014, so 5 years ago, making the exact same claim by a different scientist, McLean, who's also a physicist and not a climate scientist. And the argument is essentially this. So first, does everybody here know what the climate sensitivity is? You know what that concept is? Have you heard that before, climate sensitivity?
No.
Climate sensitivity is, when people who are trying to be scientific, climate science deniers, that's what they talk about is climate sensitivity. Specifically, it means what would be the increase in temperature with a doubling of CO2 from pre-industrial levels, right? That's the climate sensitivity.
Okay.
So that's the big question. So, like, you can't question that we're putting CO2 into the atmosphere, right? And you can't really even question that there is a hothouse effect from CO2.
Yeah, but they do question that.
The question is, how much is that effect, right? So you could say, okay, yeah, there's an effect, but it's insignificant, which is the same as saying it doesn't exist.
Right.
But they say that's climate sensitivity. So what is the climate sensitivity? Well, we don't know. There's a range of answers, and that range, the sweet spot is between 2 and 4 degrees C above, for doubling. So it's probably like 99% probably somewhere between 2 and 4. But they'll say, oh, yeah, but it could be 1. It could be less than 1. It could be really low. If you look at other papers, it shows that this, the range is even much wider. But, yeah, you're looking – so they're looking at the long tail of outliers and at one way – yeah, if you go 3 standard deviations away from the evidence that we have. So that's irrelevant. But what this related argument is, and this – I've read articles also that say that cloud cover is the last refuge of the climate-denying scientist because this is where there's the most uncertainty in our climate models because the effect of climate change on clouds and the effect of clouds on the climate – is complicated. Sure. And it's very, and so there's a, and where there's complexity and uncertainty,
that's where, and maneuver.
That's where the deniers live. It's all about doubt and confusion. Yeah. And so that's, you live in where we have the most uncertainty. So, but here's the quickie version of what we do know, and that is that the clouds do have a huge impact on the temperature.
On the weather or on the
temperature?
Climate?
On temperature. Okay. Right, on climate. Yeah.
Overall.
Yeah, yeah. Because, so low lying clouds are dense, and they reflect a lot of light back to the sky.
Cumulus clouds.
Whatever the low ones are.
Cumulus.
Yeah. So they...
Cumulus are the fluffy ones,
so,
right?
Yeah.
But they have to... So they're low to the ground and dense is the key.
Okay. Well, how low? Because then it turns into fog.
Not that low.
Okay.
Pre-fog. The altitude and the density matter. So if they're dense enough, they reflect a lot of light. So they increase the albedo. If they're thick,
I knew he was going to throw that in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, that's the density. So that's albedo. If they're low to the ground, then they're almost the same temperature as the ground. And so they don't really impact the absorption of radiation of heat, right? Because it's the same temperature. But if the clouds get higher, they get cooler. And the cooler they are, the more heat they absorb and trap. Okay. And so then they have more of a heating effect. Mm-hmm. So clouds both increase and decrease temperature by these two different mechanisms. And the balance all depends on the density and altitude of the clouds. The higher and thinner the clouds, the more light gets through, the less heat gets out. The denser and lower they are, the less light gets through and the more heat that gets out. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Are there like biomes around the globe where clouds are really consistent?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Like the rainforest.
Yeah. So, but the cloud cover is not as dynamic as it is.
Well, it's always, there's always a certain amount of
Well, also, but also there could be multiple cloud layers. You could have cumulus clouds close to the Earth.
Sure.
You can, you could have,
I'm just wondering if there are places where like that would be a good place to test long-term changes in climate because it's
And that's data that we are gathering.
Okay.
So that's something we are getting. And some of the problems, and even like Mike McLean admitted in his paper, well, we only got data going back to 1980, so this is really the hypothesis. So we need more, we need more data going forward on cloud cover. So that's partly why even the, the models are just like, we don't have enough. We don't have 100 years of really good information about cloud cover and density.
And if we don't have pre-industrial numbers, then what is the really, like we're already in the model.
Basically, what's been happening over the last 50 years and how does that correlate with temperature, right?
Yep.
So it is true that clouds have been, are becoming, basically there's a decrease in low cloud cover recently over the last 50 years. So, and that would correlate with warming, right?
Because
there's less of the reflecting of the light back. So that's what the new paper is saying.
So it's like a snowball effect right there.
You're correct, unfortunately. So that's the other element. So there's the, what's the effect of clouds on temperature, right? And which I described.
And how are they affected by temperature?
Right. Then there's the, what is the feedback of clouds on the climate? So as it gets warmer, are clouds going to mitigate the warming or enhance the warming?
Right.
And we don't know that
or
either.
Both.
Yeah.
Or they will do both, but the question is, what's the net effect? Will do both. The question is, what's the net effect?
That sounds impossible to determine.
It's not impossible. It's just really difficult. But there's the climate denying scientist Lindzen. You guys, if you ever read a scientist saying that the climate change is not real, it's that guy, right? He's Spencer and Lindzen, like the
Because they are climatologists.
Yes, who like the two outlier
characters. They're the two. George
Lindzen.
These are two people I want a letter to go to when I die.
So Lindzen's whole point is that the cloud changes in cloud cover are a negative feedback loop that will completely mitigate global warming, so don't worry about it, right? That's basically his position.
Oh, like God's going to work it out.
It's all just whatever. Yeah. The feedback is going to keep it, homeostatic.
That's lucky. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, isn't it?
Right, we can just pump as much CO2 as we want. The clouds will take care of it.
Forget about it.
But what do they say about warming that's clearly happened the past 10 years?
Yeah,
every
right?
year is the hottest year ever.
That doesn't exactly fit. Okay. So, but the range of possibilities are from a little negative to positive. It could be nothing on average, but it's actually the more recent data is trending towards there's probably a positive feedback loop from the change of clouds from global warming, which is bad, right? So that's what you were saying.
Right.
If the cloud cover, like low lying clouds, less as the planet warms, that would be a positive feedback loop on global warming. That's a bad thing. So this is like the most recent data on what is actually happening to the clouds over the last 50 years. As the planet warms, two things are happening. The clouds are getting higher and thinner. That's bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're moving towards the poles. That's also bad,
mm-hmm.
because the poles already are white. And so there's no increase in libido from going from white
libido.
Snow.
Albedo.
Yeah,
he did. Because I'm saying, right there, Steve, which is a completely true statement. There's no change in libido.
There is something about what's happening with the clouds and balding.
Yes.
Right? So the...
No.
wait, watch. The clouds move back and it gets thinner.
Yeah.
And there's a change in libido. Right, George?
There's no change in libido. Wait a minute.
And Steve, you're right.
The libido's not the problem, George.
I think you're right, though, because at some point it gets so hot, you just don't want to have sex.
Yeah.
It's too hot.
So, as I was saying, there's no change from snow to clouds with albedo, right?
So wait, once again, just as a refresher, they get higher, the clouds get higher and thinner, and how does that affect the...
So the higher they are, the more they trap the heat.
Gotcha.
And the thinner they are, the less they bounce back.
Which is terrible if they're hovering over the poles, because that's already...
No, but the problem is that when they go to the poles, So you're taking clouds that are reflecting light.
It's white on white.
Yeah,
you
know, it's white on white.
No impact.
It's it has an impact when they're below the poles.
Gotcha. And
but it's not.
It's because
it's
of the albedo.
Increasing the albedo.
So it's a massive
ice.
It's a massive decrease trapping in albedo.
It's trapping the heat, which is a problem.
At the poles.
Because the poles are warming faster. Like we're seeing greater rates of glacial.
Once the snow melts, then that effect will probably go away.
Right, then yay.
Once the snow melts, we won't be here anymore.
The game's over. That's exactly. Trying to prevent that from happening.
We'll be with, what was Waterworld?
Yo, Kevin Costner.
We'll be hanging with Kevin on
this. So, what all this means is that the clouds are probably a positive feedback loop, which is bad. That is also what's wrong with these papers.
Because they're giving us the opposite.
So they're assuming the wrong cause and effect. They're saying, oh, look, if the clouds are getting, the low-lying dense clouds are getting less as the planet's warming. Therefore, it's causing the warming. It's like, but actually, the warming is causing the change in the clouds.
Right, isn't that
what's that's part of a positive feedback loop. So actually, you're just demonstrating a bad thing about why global warming is even worse than we thought it was.
I noticed something that you do, Steve.
Yeah.
When you're citing a paper that's wrong, you always do this. You always say, so the researchers, they say, oh, look. You always say that.
that's my sarcasm setup.
Is it your sarcasm?
It's also, it just shows this kind of, this need that the human mind has to simplify things down to a single variable.
Yeah.
Sure. Oh, it's just the cloud. Like, no, climate change is not one thing.
We love simple answers.
Global warming is probably, arguably, like, the most complex thing that humans are trying to unravel right now.
It's stochastic in so many ways.
It is. It is very
top five.
It's in the top five.
It is very – and I think of the sciences that are –
Top five, top six.
That are being denied, it's probably the most complicated one.
Okay, like, what is that from?
It took me a long time to figure out, like, what's the current consensus on the effect of clouds on global warming and vice versa. And that was like, took me a lot of time. And most people aren't going to spend that time. And so you can read a paper that sounds like, oh, this man, look, it's tracking really nicely. That makes sense. You know?
And this was written by scientists and published in a preprint. Like, anybody who doesn't have the science literacy would be screwed.
No, it takes a pretty high level. And in fact, most of the people who were emailing me were like, you know, there's some red flags here. Like, the guy's mostly citing himself in the red. Like, there are six references, and four of them are himself.
Also,
that's a red flag.
Also, only six references is a red flag.
That's only six is a red flag.
That's like watching a porno of yourself.
Yeah. Okay.
You just don't do that.
My school paper.
Yeah, that'd be weird.
My school papers that are five pages long have, you know,
20, 30, 40,
40, 50, I mean,
a typical scientific publication of hundreds of
references. Like, you can't.
And he didn't account for what the rest of the scientific community are saying. So you're not addressing the likely, you know.
Yeah.
And plus, when you read the paper, it's, you know, again, like, let me find the line.
Each reference says Master Ibid.
the first six words were, in this paper, we will prove. Yeah. Right there.
Yeah, that's bad.
No. Scientists, they don't say, we're going to prove this. They didn't prove shit. You
know? Letter to the editor. You ain't proved shit.
So even when you have really, really compelling evidence, they say, you know, the data is consistent with this interpretation or suggests or blah, blah, blah.
They're not even being humble with their
research. They don't say, look.
We will provide compelling evidence to support the theory.
When you start throwing around the word prove right there, it's like, why even read past
that? Yeah, but Steve, again, this is one of those things, like, I didn't know that until you just said it.
Yeah.
Which means that probably a lot of people
hear that's a scientific literacy thing. That's, you know, scientists know that, right? A scientist would read this and go, this guy's a jerk.
Because you wouldn't pass the first science paper.
Who here is a patron and knew that using the word prove in this paper was bullshit?
Yeah, it's a red flag.
Good for you.
Yeah. Look at that one flag. Yeah. Because we can't hear that on the podcast.
Yes.
Half the hands went up.
How come I didn't know that? You see, you're not educating us enough.
You're right.
No, I think you're not listening enough because they did.
Listen to the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, listen to this. Read our book.
There are people who speak in absolutes.
So all this paper proved is that they're an asshole.
Well, listen, this is among the last holdouts of the climate.
We hope they'll come up with something else.
Oh, yeah, well, that's my thought too. Yeah. Is that they'll invent something else.
Sure, although, you know, there is a little bit of movement, you know, in terms of even some of the politicians who are against it are starting to say, I guess we should start to look for some actual, you know, solutions we can
conceding.
Live with.
They keep conceding points. It's like more and more concessions. More and more.
It's happening, but it's not because of us.
Yeah. Well, it's because of us, but what are you going to do? Yeah. Well, what are you going to do?
But what about China?
You can't prove. And the last one will be, it's too late.
Right.
6 weeks ago.
Yeah, right.
Remember when they said it was too late? And then,
right. Wait a minute. Do you think it's a coincidence that George is saying the 6 weeks thing and then he asked all of us how we want to die?
Right. Yeah, I know. We're all planning our funerals here on stage.
What do you know, George?
George, what the f*** is going on?
All right, but it's not all bad news, because Jay's news item is about how we're going to prevent global warming.
Yay. Right.
Sort of.
Yeah, this is intense. All right, so you guys probably read the headline about how if we plant an incredible amount of trees, that we could capture capture a lot of carbon. Yeah, it's a lot. There's a lot of detail here, so I gotta definitely refer to my notes. So the quick thing about it is that we need to plant the right kind of trees – in essentially the exact right kind of places to have this be really effective, because you know, the soil is different and the trees that, you know, you can't just plant any kind of tree anywhere. So there's a lot of calculating on that. But this study that they did is really cool. So the quick headline is that we could capture a significant amount of carbon dioxide over the next 40 years if we do this. So Tom Crowther, who is the author of this recent study, he's a professor of global ecosystems ecology at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. He and his team studied about 80,000 satellite image measurements. I don't think it was 80,000 images, but they had all of these measurements that were taken from satellites about tree cover, and then they merged that tree cover data with really, really detailed databases that contain soil and climate information about each hectare, right? A hectare is 2,471 acres or 10,000 square meters. That's huge. You understand meters?
Yeah.
Okay. So I love this guy. I can't help it. That's so awesome. So this effort that they did resulted in a global map showing just how many trees that the Earth could actually support, which is really, really cool. And it also shows where new forests could be cultivated in areas that have little tree growth now, little to no tree growth. And this, of course, excludes places that already contain forests, urban development areas, farmland, and then places like deserts where it would be a Herculean effort to make anything grow there. So they said that the result was 0.9 billion hectares that could be forested. So the calculation, 0.9 billion hectares, which is 10,000 square meters. So 10,000 times 0.9 billion, if you're interested in the number, that's the number of area on the surface of the Earth where we could have fully grown new forests. And if we do this, they would capture 205 gigatons of carbon dioxide. To give you, now these are numbers and like these hectares and all this, like we can't just easily understand the size and everything. So seeing a map of the United States, you know, we don't have one, and just because it's a podcast, the audience can't see it, but you could easily find this map online, and it shows you areas that are in green that could be forested, and areas in blue that are currently forested, and areas in gray that cannot be forested. And let me tell you, it's a huge amount of land. It's just an enormous amount of land that we could be planting these forests.
And so when you say could be, can you just one more time review what that means? Like, we're not displacing anybody. The ground can support it. We don't have to terraform or do anything, or we do.
No, there are some problems with it.
The big problem is water.
Yeah, so water, forests.
Oh, so this is not places where there's sufficient water.
They don't know yet. They haven't gone there yet. But they're just saying, like, this is where we could put trees.
We'd have to, like,
there are a few problems.
Concrete
and even the quote-unquote detractors, and I won't even call them detractors, because anybody that I read that was saying, well, this, well, that, you know, it's basically science is happening. Other people are coming in and saying, hey, don't forget to calculate this in and think about that.
And they're also just saying, you know, this might not be enough.
Yeah.
And it's a
well, it's not going to be enough.
No, and it's also not practical to do it at the level.
I wouldn't even say that, because because other scientists are saying, do it. This is a great idea.
Sure, it's a good idea.
Let me finish. I'm not done. Hold on. I got a lot more to say. So they're saying we have to be considerate to the fact of growth for more farming, because we need more farmland as the population grows. Mm. That there's current populations that use land for other things, that it doesn't need land. But, you know, we're not also calculating in, like, for some reason, like, massive spikes in, like, we need more land to live on, like, which would turn into be urbanized land. But it's just, this is where things are right now. Mm. Let me give you some more information, because this is interesting. The cost is estimated to be $300 billion USD.
That's it.
It's not that expensive.
Planting trees is cheap.
You could even double that and it's still within reach.
Yeah.
Another
it's
benefit,
a lot of money, but it's not a deal breaker.
Well, right.
Well, and
no,
we're
not talking global.
About the US.
It's not like global.
One check global. One
that's
day,
nothing
right?
global. Yeah, yeah, that's no, not a lot of money.
Let's continue because the information here is really cool. It's not just the headline. I say, I read the headline. I'm like, cool. And then, you know, you read the details and you're like, wait a second, this is reachable. Another benefit with forests is that it would restore biodiversity that we've lost. We've lost a ton of biodiversity. Yeah. So this would save more species from going extinct, which is great. It provides food. It would provide medicine. It will provide clean water. And it gives evil spirits a place to hide.
Because they're calculating foresting regions with the the native plants that would have grown.
Yes.
There.
Yes. Oh, no, it's all going
to
be.
This is worldwide, right?
Yes, worldwide. Absolutely. Worldwide. It has to be a global effort.
We need their buy-in.
But this is basically saying, like, we need to go into the Amazon and replant all of the places where they're gold mining and clearing, clear-cutting.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, obviously, well, yeah. But that's a geopolitical conflict.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you get people on board?
One way I look at this is that this is the upper limit of what we could achieve with complete reforestation.
Yeah.
That's potential. We're never going to hit
with
it. We're never going to hit 100% of our potential.
Right.
But and let's put it in perspective. So it was like 200 and something gigatons.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how much we emit a year? About 36 gigatons, right? So that's
another interesting fact,
six,
though.
7 years of CO2 emissions.
Right, so, but that's – wait, there's a couple things.
Yeah.
To give you an example, so – that figure, 200 and whatever,
yeah,
is two-thirds of everything that has been released from today all the way back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
But it's more important to know about going
that's
forward.
That's true. But Steve and I were
but
talking.
But those are mitigation efforts at that point.
Yeah,
we can't undo the past.
It just gives us time.
Yeah, exactly.
It may just slow things down a little bit so that when we do everything else, you know, whatever. If we're racing against the clock, we need to do everything. This
exactly
is one of the things we
and
need to do.
And the scary thing is that both reforesting and all of the mitigation efforts that were like cutting are being cock-blocked by powers that be who just don't believe that it matters or they don't care enough that it matters.
Yeah, they're just too. Yeah.
George
has a
good
take in terms of like, okay, if it started tomorrow.
All right, so they said it would take 40 years. No, the whole effort.
Two generations.
It's, there's a couple of numbers they threw out.
So but that's just for them to mature.
That's part of that.
So I've seen a spectrum from 40 years
to
100 years for the forest to fully mature. They would instantly start pulling, you know, as the trees grow, they start pulling. And then when they get full grown, then the pulling is done. Then they won't do anything else.
Then they just store it.
Which is great because, as we know, like when we cut down trees and use trees as products and everything, we're re-entering that carbon into the system.
So it's self-limiting.
Yes.
But it's also –
which is good.
Not the only reason to plant trees.
No, but that's right. That was the wonderful thing that I read in this article was that, you know, you're not – it would be great for the environment in so many different ways outside of global warming. It's just a good thing for us to do.
And it's also not just a carbon sink. It's a shade cover.
Yeah.
So you have this simultaneous interesting issue. Like I remember we covered this on SoCal Connected where there's a negative correlation between tree cover and poverty in almost every industrialized area the richer the neighborhood, the more it's planted, which is unfortunate.
Kara, did you ever read this stat, like in cities like London who have a lot more tree cover, like the average temperature of that city?
It's way down.
It's lower than you would expect. Now, because what I don't understand is does the tree help mitigate
the canopy?
Heat exchange? Like,
It literally blocks the sun from hitting the concrete.
Yeah.
That's really what it is. The concrete has a really high albedo.
Yeah, yeah.
And the trees actually shade all the places that are sinks. So like sports fields and things like that. And so what you end up seeing is that the poorest people are living in the hottest, least biodiverse areas with less access to food, especially in places like Los Angeles where trees equal food.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Could we really make a difference in time? I mean, come on.
Yes, absolutely, we could.
Really?
So.
Because if we had the political will to start doing this, we'd also probably have the political will to start doing mitigation.
But it's not just our political will. We're talking about the political will of the entire
world. Well, that's what I meant by we.
I don't think this is as...
Nothing like this has ever been done. We've never had global...
Another good reason
we have to globalize. This was the whole thing about recycling was like act locally, think globally.
Yeah.
Like nobody's thinking... You know, who's really thinking globally? Like we need our governments to work together.
I'll tell you what, millennials think globally.
Yeah,
they do. They have to.
How about if we took that... what if we use technology instead? Take that a piece of that $300 billion and invest it in technology that could actually pull the carbon out of the atmosphere.
We need to do that too.
But this is cheap.
That's the thing. $300 billion is cheap across the globe. Technology is going to cost a lot more than
trees
that.
Trees are a carbon scrubbing technology that we have right now.
Here's something we could do. It's relatively easy. It's pretty fast. It's just going to cost money. Well, you know?
And this can be amortized. Like in LA, we actually have these cool programs from the city where they give trees to people. Yeah. Like if you want a tree in your yard, you can go get one for free from the city. And they'll, like, help you with it. So there's, like, if we saw more municipalities kind of doing their part and taking on a little bit of that burden. Yeah. Because ultimately, it helps them. Like, it's going to make things better for the municipality.
How does California deal with the water issue, though?
Our water issue? Mm-hmm. It's tough, right? Because I think the thing is, you have to grow native plants. Yeah. That's the biggest thing. We do have trees. We have elms. Live oaks. Yep. Grow natively in my neighborhood. So we know that they have the potentiality to be low water intensive trees. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, if you look around LA, most of the trees you see are palms or yucca, which don't naturally grow in LA. They brought them all in from Mexico. Yeah. And it's like, I think a lot of that is just educating people about if you're going to be doing your own landscaping, only use native plants.
Yeah, you know that reminds me of the Native Americans who lived in California before the white man took their land. They had acorn culture. They lived off the oak trees and they
we had tons of live oaks. Yeah. You could grow live oaks like
we think
bananas.
Of palm trees when we think of LA, but that's all fake.
One of the most effective types of diplomacy across the globe is science diplomacy.
Yeah.
We've seen this time and time again
that
scientists across borders will work together long before you see government leader. So I think
it's
that this is
in orbit right now.
We've seen it between North and South Korea. Like we've seen really interesting diplomacy
because they don't
happen.
Give a shit. Like scientists
want to just solve these problems. Yeah.
So this news item was the one. It was a milestone news item for me. It was the marker in my head. It helped me open a part of my brain where I'm like, okay, our politicians are still like quibbling over they're
bringing snowballs into the center.
Yeah, they're not doing. Anything like we need to like this study comes out that this study comes out and we should be like okay so when can we start like seriously like okay this is a no-brainer planting trees is not going to do anything bad as long as we're planting local stuff let's just start doing it like I understand lots of other things take a lot of time and all
but unfortunately the governments have the money
but that's what I'm saying the problem is that we're all suffering and people are just like oh no there's nothing to argue about anymore when are we going to actually see some real stuff hit the ground and start happening
that's a good question
when it's too late
all right Evan so a lot of people recommended this to us as the dumbest thing of the week
and I totally agree with them we've heard about the principal in Florida who made some interesting comments or it was reported recently that he had been making some very interesting comments to the people of Boca Raton. So it's the principal of Spanish River High School. His name, William Latson.
Florida man.
Yes, Florida man.
Okay.
Florida man's a thing.
He's up to no good.
Yeah. So he told a parent that as a public school official, he needs to remain politically neutral when it comes to teaching Holocaust education. Yes, that is what he said. In fact, he said in a as part of a long email exchange he had with one particular parent, here's his exact word. I can't say the Holocaust is factual or a historical event because I'm not in a position to do so as a school district employee.
What?
Yeah, that's in writing.
So wait, what do school district employees do?
I mean, it's a ridiculous statement in so many ways.
I'm not empowered to teach.
And implicit in that is that the Holocaust is not a historical fact.
Exactly.
It's a political opinion.
Right. And it got worse because he doubled down essentially. Not everyone believes the Holocaust happened, and you have your thoughts, but we're a public school, and not all of our parents have the same beliefs, so they will react differently. You know, I mean, so insert something like biology or something instead of Holocaust or math or anything. You know, I mean, is this the attitude that this fellow?
That guy should lose his job so fast he gets whiplash.
So he's been reassigned, and
this is unconstitutional.
You know what? That's a good question, Kara. Yeah. I don't know if it violates federal level of.
Is it privileging a religion?
It's pseudoscience. Pseudo-history.
Yeah, I guess
He's been reassigned. There's a hearing coming up in 2 weeks in which they're going to discuss his future. He's probably going to be gone.
And was this because parents, spoke up?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
The Jewish population in Boca Raton.
Yeah, Boca Raton in Florida. There's a couple Jewish people down there who may still have some, relatives.
What did that guy say? Murray, let's get him.
He also
did you hear about the principal? what a shunt.
This is the principal saying, I work to expose students to certain things, but not all parents want their students exposed, so they will not be, and I can't force that issue.
Oh, so he's blaming the parents now.
Yeah, that's right. Which is a.
Are there any Holocaust denying parents in the school? I mean, why is he responding to something, or is he just a comment?
No, this is his. These are his personal thoughts.
Yeah,
these are his thoughts that he's interjecting into the.
Oh, I think I bet no parents have said anything to him.
But even if one has, and he's being like, you know, afraid of this pandering. One person, it doesn't matter. Yeah,
right.
Even if he's pandering to one person, like the needs of that one person,
what the trigger for that was. I mean, because that's kind of. Out there, you know. Why does he think that it's a political question?
Steve, I think that's all just BS.
He's black male, so I don't know that he's...
I don't want to make any assumptions.
He's black?
Yeah.
That doesn't make a lot of sense.
So, you know, it's just... is it just woeful ignorance? Is it that level of woeful ignorance? Maybe.
Is it misguided political correctness? I mean, what does
misguided...
I don't know. I don't...
combination?
This isn't one of those things that slip through the cracks, like not knowing the earth is round. Remember that comedian
Shepherd,
on The View? Yeah.
Sherry.
Like, this is... You have to, like...
You have to be steeped in the conspiratorial culture to...
Yeah, you have to be, like,
be
fully involved to get there.
You'd think so. Here's a few stats you can chew on. Mm-hmm. More than two... This is from the United Kingdom. More than 2.6 million British people think the Holocaust is a myth. 8% of the British people say that the claims and scale of the genocide has been greatly exaggerated. That was 2018. Also from 2018, 31% of Americans, 41% of millennials believe that 2 million or fewer Jews were killed in the Holocaust. And also that overall 66% of millennials today who have opinions about the Holocaust that are not in line with the facts.
What? 66%?
Didn't you say, what was this one you said about Auschwitz?
Yeah. Oh, that's it. Yeah, that's it. 66% of millennials cannot say what Auschwitz was.
They didn't know what Auschwitz was.
Did not know what Auschwitz was.
Okay, so that's ignorance versus denial.
Yeah, there's a difference.
That's different. They're like, I've not heard that word.
The stat from Britain, though, sounds like denial.
That's denial.
Is there anyone from Britain here? You, sir? Can you explain to us what's going on here?
You're a foreigner.
Yeah. Yes, foreigner, stand up in the back. Explain yourself.
There's obviously a lot of groups that study the trends of the study of World War II and specifically the Holocaust, Auschwitz, and other things. The trend markers are going in terrible directions.
Yeah.
Essentially, as the population gets older and dies off, and the newer people are coming in, they are not being informed correctly. I think that's about as nicely as
there's political will behind this,
without a doubt.
All right, then.
Thanks for closing with
that. So, dumbest thing of the week, yes.
Makes me angry. Mm-hmm. Angry right now.
Remember 6 weeks ago, before the white nationalists?
It's all starting to...
They made the clouds make it really hot.
It was the funeral and the Steve's
and the libido.
Yeah. That was great. Good times. Good times.
Yeah.
And the pickles.
Okay, Bob said something, too, but nobody
really. All right, Bob. Bob's going to do science or fiction.
Yes.
Yay.
It's time for science or fiction.
So this is going to be a little different.
But you're doing science or fiction?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He threw that on me like yesterday.
By the way.
Okay, Steve.
Deal with
No, it was earlier in the week.
Okay.
I remembered it yesterday.
So this one's a little bit different. I'm doing a themed science or fiction, and it's about three speakers for the conference.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So number one of the speakers, Randy Hutter Epstein, ran against Chris Christie for president. Two, Brant McDuff has a friend's placenta in his freezer and plans to make a haggis with it. Science or fiction?
Holy shit.
Three, Debbie Goddard has been arrested twice for protesting.
Okay.
Two are true, or science, and one is completely made up.
Poll the audience.
Poll the audience? George is good at polling. Oh,
we'll do a single clap. You know the deal? When I come like, boom, you do a clap. Let's just try one together. Here's a clap. Okay, that's so how you vote. So.
Chris Christie for president. Ran against Chris Christie for president. Two, has a friend's placenta in his freezer. Has been arrested twice for protesting.
So first two are pretty much tied, right? Yeah.
No, I think number one was
I think.
Okay.
All right.
Randy Hutter Epstein, Bob.
Yeah.
She ran against Chris Christie for president. I do think that of the three, that one is the most likely to be the fake, but I want to read the other two. Brant McDuff has a friend's placenta in his freezer, and this is so ridiculous that I believe it. You want to make haggis with it? But what? Haggis, It's I mean, why add that to an already completely effed up recipe?
You know what would make haggis
How can
even
I make
better?
This worse? Like,
how else are you
what can I add to this to make this even more disgusting? I know, my friend's placenta.
Shit.
Whoa, that's good flavor there. Yeah, that's great. That's good. You can really taste the placenta.
Holy
what
shit.
What do you mean you don't want any? There's plenty. Plenty to go around.
It's like getting laid. Anyway, I had to shut you down. Debbie Goddard absolutely got arrested twice for protesting. That is fact. Brant McDuff is so strange. That's fact. Randy did not run against Chris Christie. That's the fiction.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So ran against...
No, you cannot... Go ahead.
Ran against Chris Christie... For president, not for some, for president of the United States.
Right. Assume whatever the hell you want. I don't know.
Well, that sucks, Bob.
All right.
I mean, when you say for president, you're implying president of the United States.
Sometimes you make the wrong implication, Jim. I'm not going to answer that, but I'll let you, based on my
interesting,
you know, non-answer. You could change
for president of something.
I'm not saying what that's for, but you know, I'm not.
Yeah, she ran for president of the Farrah Club. Thanks, Bob.
I debated internally.
This is when you complain.
You have to complain now.
I'm okay. I thought enough to ask the question.
Yes, today. I was hoping somebody.
I was going to
president of the United States.
Somebody would assume that realize that that's an assumption.
Yes.
So that Jay, come
if
on,
it's not of the United States, that makes
the audience. It's all scuttled. The audience didn't know it. I didn't know it.
Well, you know, I'm assuming some. Bob, these some are our background
patrons.
Level.
These
of
are our patrons.
Here.
We can't do this shit to people.
You're
I mean, look at him. He's got tears in his eyes.
I know she lives in New York, and Christy lives in New Jersey. But maybe, I don't know, maybe she was in New Jersey for a time. I don't know. So that, you know, sure, that's plausible once you ask the right question. And then the placenta one, it's weird, but people do that sort of thing. But
they do? They do placenta haggis?
I've never heard the placenta
haggis. They've rounded up the pills.
Yeah,
people eat placenta.
Yeah, but usually that's like a wooey, like, I want to get long hair and glowing skin.
So the question is, why would a skeptic do it? That's my question. Yeah. Unless there's some...
Unless they're just like, it's organ meat. It's all the same. Put it in the haggis.
No. Or it's a dare or something.
He didn't say human.
You said that their friend's placenta.
Oh, they did say their friend. He could be friends with a goat.
I assume.
I don't know.
Or their friend's goat's placenta, yeah.
You could assume that
this recipe is getting weirder and weirder. So I'm friends with a goat, and I'm using his placenta.
Sorry.
No, it's complex. I'm telling you. I don't judge a goat's sexuality. It's not my place. Whatever goat wants to identify as, you know, if she wants to be she or he, it's fine.
It's fair.
And then the thing about Debbie Goddard is. That could be the fiction if she was arrested more than twice.
No.
It would have to be 20 times.
All right. It was 3 times.
That was leading towards the end.
All right, that's good. So, that's something you
would
call.
That may be
the gotcha because it's so believable, but I'm going to go with the placenta one as the fiction.
Huh. Okay, Evan.
Okay, so, the first one about running for president, I don't understand it, Bob. I mean, besides running for president of the United States, what else do people... run for? I mean,
student body president?
Well, book club? Yeah, something like that. It would be student body president.
Did they go to high school together?
Maybe. It could be. That could be. So that would be that one. The placenta one is super strange. But, you know, not inconceivable. And the third one is pretty ordinary. So, yeah. Guess I'm going to have to go. I'll say with Steve. I'll say it's the one with the placenta. Mm. I don't think that's.
Kara.
So I interviewed Randy for my podcast.
Oh, damn.
And we talked for an hour, and Chris Christie's name never came up. So she's an MD, MPH, but she doesn't work at the – I mean, she has a position at a university, but she's not a professor. So I don't think she would have been running for anything at a university again. And what would Chris – the only thing I can think of is if they went to high school together, which
president
would be weird.
Club.
Yeah.
Yeah, like if they both ran for student body or president against each other in high school, which would be hilarious. Or, like a condo board or something. That would be so weird. And it might be true.
You don't want that. That is the
– I wouldn't want that. That sounds like a lot of work.
That is everybody that ever got that job turns into an a-hole.
Yeah, of course.
Don't do it.
Does absolute power corrupt absolutely?
It does.
I think it does, even in the condo.
Move those garbage pails.
Okay. So
Don't slaughter sheep in the backyard.
It could be.
Stop. You're not your cooking haggis. Placenta there, are you?
It could be that she ran against him in some obscure thing when they were young. But that feels like a long shot to me. The other two seem more reasonable, so I'm just going to go with my gut and say that it was, yeah, that Randy never ran against Chris Christie. Yeah.
Okay, George.
I was leaning towards Debbie.
In accent. Do answer in your accent. Whatever you want. I don't care.
I was thinking Debbie was arrested more than twice. I was leaning with Steve as well. But I think
but it
now,
would have to be like 20 times.
That's
right?
What I'm thinking, yeah.
Or maybe, now, maybe she's never been arrested.
Well, arrested, maybe it's a weird thing. Maybe she's been detained or something. Because I know she's hardcore. So I'm going to go with Debbie. I'm going to say that Debbie is the... Oh.
Okay, good.
So no sweep.
So pull the audience
no
again.
No sweep, yeah. Crap. Okay. All right. So number one, Randy ran against Chris Christie for president. Okay. Two, Brandt placenta thing.
Ooh.
Three, Debbie Goddard arrested.
They're so easily swayed by Steve.
Don't be, I have a terrible record.
Horrible.
Okay, Bob.
Okay, so let's start at the top here. I don't even remember who voted for what, so I won't even care. So Randy Hutter Epstein, she is talking Sunday 10:50 AM and her talk is Aroused, a History of Hormone Healers and Hucksters. Sounds fascinating.
She's awesome.
She ran against Chris Christie for president of high school.
Student body. I called it. I know.
And she lost. She lost. This is 1979, which she authorized me releasing that day.
Bob,
Riggs in high school.
Bob, what does that look like?
She authorized
me releasing
the
chance.
What does that look like to you?
I don't know. A little violin? I don't know.
Looks like an asshole.
Don't beat yourself up, Jay. Don't beat yourself up. I gave him the chance.
We got a shot.
Two, Brant McDuff, Sunday, 4:30. He's closing out the conference. A Brief History of Taxidermy. I heard he's awesome, so I'm definitely going to check that out. Especially considering that he literally has a friend's placenta in his freezer, and he wants to make haggis with it, and he said... He said, I've been after one for a long time. It's the only human flesh that's legal to eat.
Oh, yeah. That's funny.
I love this guy. I would never do it, but I love this
that's
guy.
That's some serious
okay.
shit.
Okay. Wow. Which means Debbie Goddard, who's speaking Saturday at 10 a.m., she's talking about the science of change, evidence-based methods for effective activism. She has never been arrested.
Nice.
Never been arrested. And, you know, I think she had a very boring life. I said, all right, give me something interesting. She's like, I have nothing. Use me as the lie. I'm like, okay, have you ever been arrested? No, I've never been arrested. But she has protested, but never been arrested. So so she is a fiction. George.
George never wins.
Never.
George.
George just so
yes.
Yay.
Thank Christ, I got it right.
Well, and we're all excited because you didn't screw up our averages.
That's right. Okay, so that's right. Good. Yeah,
we're all still in the
now,
same
Now, George, we've been preparing for this because you've never won science
no,
or fiction.
He's won.
I'm talking
about never, ever. Not once.
So what we're willing to give you is a funeral of anyone you choose.
But it has to be this week. Yeah. Yeah. 4 days. The coupon's good for 4 days. Nice. I want at my funeral just like play my tunes. And aww. Every silly like YouTube
you
video.
All about
of
you,
me.
George.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
Duh.
That's all I want.
My celebration for my death will be the heat death of the universe. That's all.
Sweet. You just want everybody to go down
now.
With you.
6 weeks from now.
I want the whole world to mourn my loss. Uh-huh. I want everyone here to be pissed off, like because their favorite show has been preempted. Bob has died.
Finally,
since that's
Steve
not
is
happen,
still doing the show, man. It's not. It's yeah. not going to stop.
What since that's not going to happen, I agree with Steve. I don't care. Whatever my daughter and my loved ones need and want, have at it. Go to town.
So we're back to this discussion now?
We had to come back because nobody asked me.
Yeah,
no one
asked Bob.
And what can you infer from that?
That you're not going to die.
That
Bob.
That it's 12:06 and time's tight.
That's what I'm getting at. Exactly. The segment was over.
We got 4 minutes.
Evan, read us a quote.
To me, science describes a world far more interesting than any psychic fantasy. It's a good world. Not perfect, but it's ours. So we better learn to live with it the way it is. Mm. James Randi. The amazing
Mother
James.
Randy. Yay!
Well, that we are a little bit over time. So thank you all for joining us for our private show here at Nexus. George, wonderful to have you.
Thank you, loving it.
Thank the rest of you for joining me up here today.
Thanks,
Steve.
Thank you, Steve. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.